Hi, I'm Monica Olson.
And I'm Jennifer Walsh.
And you're listening to the Biophilic Solutions Podcast, where every other week we sit down with experts and thought leaders in order to explore the innate connection between humans and nature and why we need nature to thrive.
We truly believe that reconnecting with the natural world and understanding our place within nature is a key to tackling the global environmental problems we face today.
So let's get to today's episode.
Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Monica.
Jen, our main topic today is deer. And I think I can speak for both of us and probably most of our listeners too when I say that there's something really magical about being out on a walk or looking out your window and seeing a deer or a family of deer.
Oh, I completely agree. They're so graceful and quiet and hold this deep fascination when you encounter them. Yet they're a fairly common presence in our lives.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I've definitely had awe experiences seeing deer out on the trails, but it's not like they're a rare animal or anything.
Absolutely. So today we're speaking with author Erica Hauser about her incredible new book, The Age of Deer. This book explores our rich and complex history with these animals, from mythology and history to their impact on our everyday lives and ecology. She's really using deer as a lens to take a deeper look at the human relationship with the natural world and the sharp lines we tend to draw between ourselves and nature.
Yeah, it was a great read. And I also want to point out that the Washington Post called this book a masterpiece. And Publishers Weekly stated, Hauser's lyrical musings cast her subject in a new light. Readers will be enthralled. So Erica holds an MFA from Brown and is the author of two poetry books as well. So in addition to this book, she's also a journalist and has contributed to a number of essays to publications like The Rumpus, LA Times Review of Books, Long Reads, and The Brooklyn Rail.
Yes, and I think her background in poetry as well as journalism are really apparent in this book. It's very factual and informative, but also so beautiful and meditative.
Yep, we highly, highly recommend it. And we hope you enjoyed this interview with Erica Hauser.
Erica, welcome to Biophilic Solutions Podcast. We are so excited to have you on the show today. We haven't stopped talking about your new book. So thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
We are too.
In the intro, listeners heard a little bit about your background, but I am fascinated how you, with the MFA and the poetry and the writing, came to this book. So maybe not so much your true background, but like, how did this book evolve in your life and in your writing?
Back in my MFA days when I was, you know, mostly thinking of myself as a poet, I did do some writing at that time about deer, and I was kind of drawing on childhood memories of being adjacent to hunting culture. So being from outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, deer hunting is a big deal there. And you would hear people talking about it in school, and you would go into people's houses and see trophy heads on the wall. And I mean, that's true for a lot of places around the country, but it was certainly a big element in my childhood experience. And there is just something very kind of vivid about that, you know, that there's something about that that really feels intense, even if you're not doing it yourself, but just kind of being near to it. So it really stuck with me, and it came out in this poetic piece that I wrote in grad school about deer. And even in that piece, I picked up some threads that carry all the way through to this book. And this is, you know, 20 plus years ago that I was doing the MFA. But, you know, I think that piece touched on the idea of deer getting into accidents on the road and the idea of deer coming into people's gardens and damaging plants and some of those themes. So then in the meantime, between getting an MFA and starting to write this book, I worked for a long time as a local journalist. And so I was able to, you know, learn just on the job some of the basic techniques of journalism. How do you interview somebody? How do you kind of figure out who to ask for certain kinds of information? So all of that really formed the foundation for being able to write a book that has this much research and travel and talking to people in it. And I think the idea for the book just sort of, I don't have a great story about one singular moment when the idea flashed into my mind. It wasn't really like that. It was more gradual. And I just think at some point I knew I had been interested for a long time in questions about nature and what is nature and what is it with these really sharp lines that we like to draw between ourselves and everything else that we call nature. I'm really interested in the gray areas where those things meet and overlap and influence each other. And at some point, I just thought, oh, deer would be a great way to ask those questions because they're all around us. They're a familiar part of daily life. They're unusual in being a large animal that's part of our daily life and lives in our neighborhoods and our cities and out in, you know, I live in a rural area and we see deer frequently here too. So there's obviously something special about an animal that's been able to adapt that well to all these different parts of our human world that we've created. And so I just thought, what a great topic. And, you know, now with all the journalism experience under my belt, I felt equipped to tackle a bigger nonfiction project where I would have to travel and talk with scientists and convince people who are rehabbing fawns to let me come and observe and do all those journalistic things, but also think about all of it in kind of a lyrical, poetic way.
That's beautiful. Well, before we even get into your background in journalism and this book, like when you were younger, were you interested in the outdoors? Were you like exploring your area in Pennsylvania, or was that not really something that you grew up with?
I didn't really grow up with that. I mean, I did grow up in a rural area. We were about an hour or so from Pittsburgh and small little village. I grew up in a house that was built in the 1700s. It's a stone house. So there's definitely a sense of history there. The landscape is, in one way, it's pretty bucolic. You know, there were sort of farms around us and woods, but in another sense, it's really part of the Rust Belt and it's been abused. You know, there's a long history of there's fossil fuels under the ground there. So there was lots of coal mining going on in those days and still is. But of course, now the new thing is fracking in that area has become a really big industry. So, you know, it wasn't like growing up in Boulder, Colorado or something like that.
Sure,
everybody's like, let's go hiking. You know, it really wasn't like that. Going outside was not necessarily part of what we did a lot, as in adventuring into a natural area. You know, we'd go out in the yard, of course, but I was really an adult before I kind of discovered hiking and backpacking and things like that.
Yeah, I grew up in a very, outside of Los Angeles, very suburban, and we did like trips to the Grand Canyon and Bryce and Zion, all these places, but wasn't same kind of thing, and moved to San Francisco and had a deeper connection to the headlands and nature and hiking. But then when I moved to Georgia, was in the city of Atlanta, but now I'm just a little bit south in the country, deer everywhere and guns and hunting and culling, and, you know, we'll get into all that. So that was not a part of my knowledge base. It was not a part of the culture I grew up in. And so it was shocking or disconcerting, but it takes education, right? And I think that's one aspect of this book, is it's really important to share knowledge with people so people have a better understanding of anything, but in this particular thing, deer. And one thing that you had said earlier about, like, you know, why deer, I think this was a quote, is that they quietly, I'm paraphrasing, occupy a middle zone between domestication and wildness. And I thought that that was very, very profound, you know, and it, you know, that you have those aha moments and you're like, oh, that's so obvious, but I've never heard it before.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, there's kind of a category of animals that I bet this term has come up on this podcast before, synanthropes. So like the root is S-Y-N with, and then anthrope. Anthropos, you know, person, human. So animals that are good at living with people. So like raccoons would be another example. They're awesome at living in and around our dwellings and kind of taking advantage of the things that we accidentally offer them. You know, black bears have a little bit of that going on. But I think that type of animal, and there are some birds, of course, who are in that category. That kind of animal is just a really, to contemplate them is a really great opportunity to see the ways that we are co-creating this world, this kind of new realm on the earth where humans and animals are living together in some new ways. And I think deer are really like that. And they're, you know, to go back to kind of where I grew up, you know, in a place where I often kind of saw the habitat as damaged or beat up. That's often how I describe it, just kind of beat up. The fact that these big, beautiful, graceful animals can still thrive in that environment is really, it is profound, you know, because we think of them as wilderness creatures and we connect them with the idea of wilderness and kind of untouched places. But the reality is they're pretty good at living among the ruins and the litter and the pollution.
Yeah.
They can thrive there.
That's so true. I'm so glad you said that, Erica, because reading your book, it was so interesting because I, for most of us or many of us, we see deer. I mean, I born and raised in New York, the Bronx and New York City, but going outside the city into Westchester County where I spent my high school years and those kind, but I spent a lot of time knowing like when there's one, there's many, or like you're like little things, but they've always coexisted alongside of us. But your book really dove in to so much more that I never thought about, that relationship to this wild animal that's so graceful and so beautiful that coexists, but also serves as food for many people and almost being wiped out at one point when you were going in the book about like thinking about, you know, these ebbs and flows of the relationship with a deer, of how they almost become extinct and how many people hunt for them and those that don't and why. And just the history of deer was something I never really thought of, but the book really was a whole new spotlight on something that has always existed next to me, but I never knew that much about. So it's really fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that because that was a big part of the goal, was just to defamiliarize them and look underneath the surface of the familiarity that we have with them. Because a lot of us have grown up just seeing them all the time and it's easy to take them for granted. But yeah, their history really, you know, for me, changed that attitude toward them. You know, I really learned to see them as an animal that easily could not have been here in our lifetimes. You know, it easily could have gone a different way and we would not be living with deer in such a common, regular fashion. And so I ended up feeling pretty grateful that they are here for all the conflicts that we have. You know, I think we're lucky to have at least one big animal in the eastern U.S. that we get to see often.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Jennifer, guess what's coming up and where we get to hang out?
What's that, Monica?
The Biophilic Leadership Summit. It's back this March 24th through 26th.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see you in person again. It's been way too long.
I know, me too. And we invite all our listeners to come to this year's summit. We're going to be exploring biophilic placemaking and how we use biophilic principles to promote health, happiness, and vitality in public spaces.
Yes, and I was just reading over the schedule, which I'm very excited about. There are so many great speakers and panels. And when you get to join us, I'll be doing a nature walk and moderating a wonderful panel on activating community spaces with two incredible women, an architect and an urban planner.
So this summit is put on by the Biophilic Institute and Biophilic Cities Project. So you can also come meet all of the leading experts in biophilia. And in addition to all incredible multiple presentations, we're going to have all sorts of great farm-to-table meals, plus cocktails, some book signings, and lots of networking, which is always a favorite. And it's going to be at your and my favorite place, the Inn at Serenbe.
Yep, that's one of my favorite places, as you know. So join us in Serenbe for the 6th Annual Biophilic Leadership Summit from March 24th to March 26th, 2024.
And you can learn more about the summit and register today at biophilicsummit.com.
That's biophilicsummit.com. We hope to see you there.
We'll see you soon. Bye, Jen.
Bye.
Right, that's not in a zoo. Or in a true right. wilderness. Can you share a little bit? I know it's hard to take history down to like a soundbite, but talk a little bit about, you know, where deer have had a place in our imagination, iconography, what they stand for. Can you talk a little bit about that? Share with our listeners.
Yeah, well, I had no idea, you know, how deep of a treasure trove I would find of stories and imagery and mythology in which they appear. And there are some themes that kind of emerge from all of that. So one thing is that we have connected them with both life and death. And I'm talking about, you know, over the millennia, like into deep time here. Obviously, they have a tremendous amount of life force. They're so alert and they're so athletic and strong, and they can leap over a 6-foot fence, and it's incredible, and they reproduce quickly. So they have this tremendous life force, but they also appear in the aspect of death a lot. And that has to do with the fact that we've hunted them throughout history. Another theme that comes up is about shape-shifting. So humans and deer that turn into each other. And there are some really stunning, beautiful stories and practices in which a person becomes a deer or marries a deer woman or has a child who's a deer or goes to live with the deer people, and they will turn themselves into deer in order to be hunted by their families. And then they come back to life when you throw the bones into the water. So there's this really beautiful, fascinating stew of images that have to do with this life and death and renewal and consuming and becoming each other, and several different practices around the world where people will put on antlers and do ritual dances, you know, so they're kind of becoming a deer, imitating the deer in order to call out to the deer and say, will you allow us to hunt you and eat you? So I think both of those threads, the life and death and the shape shifting, they both have a lot to do with hunting, and they both have a lot to do with consuming the flesh of deer, which is something that many human cultures have depended on as a staple food. And, you know, we've used their hides as clothing. So it's like their skins are covering our skins, or we're living in shelters that are made from their skins. And then all these other objects in daily life might be made from their hides or their bones. Or this is one of my favorite ones. There are cultures that have used, we all have, and deer have a sac that surrounds the heart, the pericardium. You can use that to make a little bag or purse. So there's just all these really interesting, deep physical connections that we've had with them. And those really are expressed in those stories and myths. I think having to hunt and kill in order to survive is something that troubles people. And so it's very uneasy. So we've had to create all these almost containers for those feelings, you know, these myths that explain why we have to do this and kind of soothe some of that anxiety about it. But that's been just a beautiful thing for me to learn more about all of that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just flashing when you were saying that the shape shifting to, there's like a Netflix show called Sweet Tooth about a little boy who was part boy and part deer. It's like a post-apocalyptic thing, but I feel like he was being hunted because of the shape, right? You know, he was part half and half. I don't know if I ever finished it, but it's interesting that it's still in modern times, we're still working through these myths. Sort of interesting.
Well, speaking of TB, the great show Reservation Dogs has this whole thread about the deer lady. So for those who aren't familiar, this is a fantastic show about Native American teenagers on the reservation. Some of the episodes contain this character called the Deer Lady, who is a traditional Native American mythical character, who is a beautiful woman who, when you look down at her feet, she has hooves instead of feet. And she has this whole really interesting role in the culture as kind of this vigilante justice person. But yeah, so absolutely, there's contemporary versions of these things for sure.
And Erica, I don't know if you have an opinion about this, but I'm curious, might be off subject a little bit, but maybe not. But I just think it's so interesting too, diving into this topic and then seeing everything on social media of people outside, and there's so many deer in their yard and people are filming their relationship, like their friendship with their local deer that come to either they feed them or they just kind of show up in the yard. Do you think social media helps education on these creatures, or do you think it hinders? I mean, again, I don't know if this is a relevant question for you, but I just, because I see deer on social media all the time and I always like it. So of course, algorithms feeding me what I like, which is like, give me more deer content. But I'm like, I think it's so interesting that people are finding these relationships in their own backyards and this like biophilic experience of having these wild animals come to the yards, and maybe they shouldn't be feeding them, but again, they're just in this awe state of being around these wild animals that are beautiful and graceful, and they know that they are not going to possibly kill them. They're not going to slaughter the family kind of thing with their their teeth or anything like that. But I'm just curious.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit skeptical about it. I'm sure it depends on the person and it depends on how it's being presented. But, you know, social media has such a difficult relationship to education in general. Yes. And feeding deer is, there's no wildlife biologist who is going to tell you that that's a good idea for the deer or for the people. Right. So just with that as a starting point, it's a little bit fraught to put food out for deer. You can be creating certain problems, and actually those problems can include physical threats to especially other people who may live nearby who are not feeding the deer. But if a deer gets used to being, you know, accustomed enough to being fed, they can end up going next door and becoming a bit aggressive looking for food from people who are not offering. That can be a problem. There can be some disease problems that are exacerbated for the deer by congregating closely and kind of sharing, you know, if you put out corn in a pile and you have several deer eating from that pile, that can help spread some diseases that we really don't want to have spreading. So there are some problems with that. But I, at the same time, I appreciate what you're saying, that people have an innate desire to connect with animals. And I think there are a lot of things about how we do that in this culture that are a bit distorted, and social media is part of what creates that distortion.
Well, and I think, don't you, you mentioned at the very beginning that we've drawn these very sharp lines with nature. And I wonder if because of that, we somehow don't see ourselves as a part of it, right? And that's the first problem. And or we see the animals the other, which creates other problems. But then we get so excited when we are connected with them that we're doing the wrong things, right? Feeding them, for example, you know, where there's like a pond here that there's some ducks congregate and it's like, do not feed the ducks, you know?
Yeah.
But we just don't know, you know, we have been so disconnected and we have drawn such sharp lines that we don't know anymore. We don't know better. And so again, I go back to, you know, one of the reasons that your work is so phenomenal is it's in this beautiful way, educating people on the goods and the bads and the opportunities and the hows. Yeah, no, it really is. And I don't know, you know, possibly the early work, again, the journalism with the poetry and the MFA, like, and then the interest in deer, like it brings it together in this really lyrical form, which I think is sort of rare. You either get this, oh, it's poetry. I don't, you know, I do or don't like poetry, or it's animal, you know, it's sort of this dry deer RS. And so it's nice to have that put together because I think it draws more people in. One of the things I wanted to touch on is sort of, you know, again, with the sharp lines, you know, I think you say like cultural carrying capacity and a biological carrying capacity. And I think it's really interesting. Can you talk about that cultural versus a biological carrying capacity for deer specifically, but I think animals?
This is a really interesting one. So I knew early on in this project that I was going to have to dive into that question of, are they really overpopulated? This is conventional wisdom that you hear a lot about deer. So big thing that I would need to tackle, like, is that true? And the first thing I did in researching that was to talk to a wildlife biologist here in Virginia. And I said, well, are they overpopulated? And he said, there are two ways to answer the question. There's biological carrying capacity, which is how many deer the habitat could sustain in a healthy way, healthy for the habitat and for the deer themselves. And then there's cultural carrying capacity, which is how many deer people will tolerate in that environment, which are two more or less unrelated numbers, two different measurements. He said, the cultural carrying capacity tends to be lower than the biological, which I thought was very interesting. But cultural carrying capacity gets exceeded when, for example, you have people getting really irritated by having their gardens eaten, or they feel unsafe driving because they're seeing too many deer run into the road, or they're having accidents. Or the other big factor with deer is Lyme disease. So folks starting to feel like we've got to do something to decrease our risk of getting Lyme. So those are all kind of social and political issues, and they're pretty separate in a lot of cases from the biological question, which is how many deer can this environment sustain? And that question has its own world of complexity to it and nuance and debate also. So it's really hard to answer that question. You know, how many deer is too many? It's really difficult. And if a community is trying to answer that question because they think they might need to take some kind of action to reduce the population, then all this emotional stuff comes up and muddies the waters even further, because people have a lot of feelings about the killing of deer. So it just gets really, really complicated.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
When you talk about the people are very emotional, I'm curious, because I feel like I read or heard you speak about Bambi. Is that when...
I just wrote that, that when you,
did you really?
I just wrote down Bambi. I was like, oh!
That was my, I mean, I grew up seeing deer, but again, like the show really, and I was young in the 70s. I know it didn't came out, what, in the 40s? And didn't you write somewhere, or say somewhere that is a real PR nightmare or something for the hunters? So I wonder, is that, do you think like that plays a part, that movie played a part in how people feel about deer, do you think?
Oh, a huge part. Yeah, it's amazing. It's got to be one of the most influential movies ever made. Wow. I'm serious, because I think it came out in 1942. It was during World War II. So it's old by now, but people still reference it constantly. Yeah. You cannot read a newspaper article about deer without seeing the word Bambi. And there is something really important about that, because Bambi in the film is, he's a victim, right? He's kind of the ultimate victim of callous human hunters. The hunters, we never see their faces. We don't know anything about them other than that they kill somebody's mom. And they also start a forest fire. So they're just totally destructive, and they cause this terrible trauma to happen. And so, yeah, at the time, the hunting community said, oh, this is really bad for us. And they objected and they wrote things about how wrong it was. But that did not really help the situation as far as they were concerned. I think there are generations of people in America who are not deer hunters, and their image of deer hunting is formed by that film.
Sure.
And their image of deer is formed by that film. And one of the really fascinating things about that whole story is that the movie was based on a novel which was written in German. I believe the author was Austrian, but I'm not certain. Hmm. Anyway, he himself was a hunter. So there's this really profound complexity that was just completely erased by the Disney version of it. You know, and that's so interesting, because it is often hunters who are the most actually interested in wildlife and know the most about specific animals and have spent the most time closely observing them. And oftentimes, you know, non-hunters might feel like, oh, I love deer, I love birds, I love animals, but we may not actually have a lot of knowledge about them.
Great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was another thing, you know, now knowing hunters who are so thoughtful and so much more steeped in wildlife and nature than I am. And they have a utmost respect. And, you know, obviously there's, I don't want to say bad hunters, but if you kill something, you take it and you use it, you know, you eat it or you give it away, you know? And so again, I'm not a hunter. It's not something that I want to do, but getting educated creates empathy and starts to give you some sort of respect. And yeah, that's so funny that I'm like Bambi. I'm like, oh, poor Bambi, you know, it's crazy, right? I mean, it was a very traumatizing movie. As a child of
it was. Yeah.
So that kind of leads into the effects of the ecosystem. You know, you kind of mentioned disease or the habitat, Lyme disease, ticks, deers carry ticks. Not all ticks are bad, but nobody likes a tick. You know, nobody's like creating a tick circus, you know, like it's not something anybody wants.
A tick circus. I've never heard that before.
A tick circus and a flea circus.
Yeah.
You know, so tell me a little bit like the ecosystem, you know, we've talked a little bit about culling and, you know, the differences there, but pathogens and the wasting disease, you know, we hear like, remember when mad cow was a thing, you know, we have this vision of you hear like, what is that chronic wasting disease and these zombie deers, like, well, the drama of whatever, the news, social media, I don't know, people were bored, you know, talk a little bit about what you learned because you do a lot of research.
Yeah.
It's all another fraught topic.
Yeah, I guess we could call that the conflict question. You're asking about different conflicts that we have with them. And that is a big part of the relationship these days. As far as disease, I mean, they are part of the life cycle of the Lyme disease bacteria. So people do sometimes start feeling, as I said before, that, you know, we've got to decrease the number of deer so that our risk of Lyme will go down. And unfortunately, that's another really complex and hard to answer question. Like, would that help? Because of how many stages there are in the life cycle of the tick. And, you know, I won't go into all of that here, but I'll just say it's a little bit hard to say that having fewer deer would mean less Lyme disease for people. I think that's a very unclear statement. You brought up chronic wasting disease, which is currently, there's no known cases of that becoming a human disease, but it is a huge problem for deer. It's spreading throughout the country. It's now in more than half of the states in the U.S. and it's in Canada and a couple other countries. And it's a very scary thing. And it has been getting more press lately, which is good because there's a general lack of awareness about it. And there's some skepticism about it. It's a little bit parallel to the COVID experience that we had where people get in their different camps and believe different things about it and, you know, won't listen to each other. So there's a lot of dimensions to that as well. But chronic wasting disease, although it has not been known to jump to humans, as you mentioned, it's similar to mad cow disease. It's a similar type of pathogen. And mad cow, we know, can be contracted by people, and that's a disaster. And if that were to happen with chronic wasting disease, we'd have a real problem on our hands. So that is somewhat separate from the everyday conflicts that we have with them on the road or the garden. But it's all part of this, because sort of, I think of it as a neighbor relationship that we have with deer. You know, you might kind of feel glad that you have neighbors, but sometimes they get on your nerves, you know, or you get in each other's way. And that's how it is with deer, you know, or family members. You know, you're kind of like, oh, I was just about to use the bathroom. Well, fine, you go first. You know, there's all this kind of just running into each other that we do.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. You're so right. I think like, I like the idea too, because we are very similar in the way we are humans and deer and traveling our packs and our family members. And it's very symbolic of how humans interact with one another and how we interact with the lives around us. So that's really fascinating. And do you think there's a symbolic similarity between that, between humans and deer?
Yeah, definitely. I think that goes back to those kind of shape-shifting stories. I think we've sensed that there's a kinship and a similarity for thousands of years. That has been a thing that humans have felt and expressed through these different art forms. I mean, for one thing, we're both mammals, and that seems like a very obvious, I'm going to say several very obvious sounding things here, but we're both mammals. We're about the same size and they're beautiful. So these are kind of really obvious points, but being in the field with hunters and seeing them cut into a deer in order to field dress it and take out the organs that they're not going to be using, or coming across a skeleton, maybe if you're hiking and you find a deer that has died and broken down and you could see the skeleton, their bodies are so similar to ours in design and in size. So that alone to me is just a very profound thing. I think I describe it in the book as being on the tree of life. We and deer are kind of on this little side branch together with the other mammals, and the whole rest of the tree is life forms that are much more different from us than deer. You know, if you think about plants and algae and fungi and microbes, you know, those are important life forms on the earth, but they're really different than us. And compared to them, deer really are kind of our cousins. There's a kinship there. And I think just the size that they are allows us to see ourselves in them more easily. And as you mentioned, they will kind of walk around in these family groups like we do. And they're also brilliant adapters and they're generalists, which is something else we have in common. You know, they're really good at kind of adapting to different conditions and habitats and putting up with noise and pollution and changes to the infrastructure. You know, if you build a new road through an area, the deer are going to adapt to that. Some of them will get hurt on that road, but most of them are going to learn how to navigate that. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we share with them. We're also very, very good at reinventing ourselves in that way.
So interesting.
It reminds me of I think this was also a quote in your book that you mentioned about, you know, we hear more and more about developments are interrupting animals' migration patterns. And so people are building land bridges and in this case, I think you were talking about a tunnel to channel the deer under the highway so they don't get hit. But I think one of the things you said is it's like, well, as humans, like, how did we suddenly have the right? I mean, it's through technology, right? Again, this is an obvious thing. How do we have the right to move through their landscape as quickly as we do, right? In these vehicles, right? We're just so used to it, but it's so unnatural. And I just, you know, it's one of those things that I think is sort of a profound thing to really think about. We as humans have this tendency to just think, well, we're here and we can do whatever we want and we're going to, you know, it's our right. Yeah. And so I think this also, you know, brings up the point of sort of, again, understanding the deer and animals is, provides more empathy and also remembering, re-educating people that we are part of nature. We're not separate from it. I think you also say that the deer is like a perfect emblem for us, you know. So I guess as we start to wrap up, like, is there anything we didn't cover? I mean, there's so much in the book and there's so much research and wonderful storytelling, but is there anything that you want to sort of share with us or impart besides go buy the book, you know, that which we'll put in the show notes and such, but such a beautiful book. So just love to any final thoughts or anything we didn't cover you'd like to share.
I did want to just mention that I too have a podcast and it is just a mini series. So it's just 4 episodes and it's a companion to the book. So if this conversation is interesting to people, then you might like that podcast, which is called If You See a Deer. And I made it in collaboration with a friend of mine from my MFA days. So that was a nice kind of full circle moment to work with him on this project where we expand on the book in certain ways. We talk to some of the same people who are in the book, but also some others, and just continue to ask these questions about our relationship to deer. So that's on all the usual platforms if people are interested.
Well, that's amazing. Great. And Erica, thank you so much for this, because what you gave to us is this incredible, beautiful gift of something like, we know the deer are there, but you gave us this great resource of information and history and storytelling and poetry and discovery that, again, you opened my eyes to, which I love our podcast for this reason. Like, there's always so much interesting.
We learned so much.
Things that are happening. Yeah, we learned so much. So I really thank you for your gift of wonderment, because you wanted to write this book, and your sense of discovery, and that, you know, the gift to share it with all of us, because I learned so much. So even though I love every chance I get to see a deer, it's always like, oh, that And I was so excited. And I was like, oh, there's a deer. And it's funny because like I stop in my tracks and I'm driving out. If I'm not driving the car, but I yell as a passenger, oh my God, because it's just, they're so beautiful. So thank you for reminding us of that beauty and that relationship that we have that should never go unnoticed of how powerful it is. So thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you for all those kind words. And I'm delighted to hear that it's kind of reawakening an appreciation or just an awareness and noticing of them, which certainly happened for me in the writing process, for sure. And thank you so much for having me on. It's been a really fun conversation.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing and for your time.
I'm so fascinated by this conversation. We definitely seem to have this innate connection with deer, given how much mythology we've created around these animals all over the world. And then I think about my own encounters with deer and how beautiful they are, and that they always stop me in my tracks, no matter where I am. But I never would have thought to connect these two ideas.
Yeah, me neither. I found it really interesting that the spark of this idea came from a poem she wrote during her MFA program. And I just think like in poetry and creative writing, we often look at things through metaphors. So she has these ideas about deer in the back of her mind for a really long time before it culminated in this amazing book.
And the book itself is such a masterful blend of scientific nature writing in raising all these big questions about our relationship with nature, our similarities with deer as a species, and just how we encounter these animals more generally. Monica, I was also really fascinated by the concept of biological versus cultural carrying capacity.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
I have always heard that deer are overpopulated and have always just assumed that meant that there's some level of culling or population control was good for the ecosystem as a whole. But I had never heard of cultural carrying capacity, which kind of throws a wrench into this whole idea.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that either. And I agree. It's really complicated my perspective on the entire issue of overpopulation. But I'm sure it's very dependent on place as well.
Absolutely. We really cannot recommend this book enough.
It's so good. So we've got the book, Erica's podcast, and more resources linked in our show notes. So head there to learn more.
Okay. Talk to you soon, Monica.
Bye, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, we would love for you to follow us on our favorite listening app. Give us a 5-star rating and please leave us a review.
Listens, follows, and reviews really go such a long way and help us share these amazing interviews and solutions for wider network.
Absolutely. And we'll be back with another great guest in a few weeks.